What about the green?
Only story about the green is we were host to the Pan Am Games. I was one of the first six uniforms produced for Training Command.
1967.
Yeah.
Winnipeg.
That's right.
I was there.
Yeah. And I was detailed to go and meet Prince Philip when he came to open the games. And I arrived at the aircraft, and the famous story was that I'd of course seen him in Germany. He was the colonel of the RCR, you see, and he'd been out to see them a couple times when I was in Germany. Of course, he came with the monarch, which he came to inspect the brigade. So I walked up to the aircraft, and he came bounding down as he is wont to do, and he said, "Oh, Dudley, what are you, a forest ranger?" And that was his first thing. And as a consequence, I was called Smokey the Bear for about 6 months by all my juniors in training command.
So, you're joking. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What, this is idea of big jokes?
Yeah.
You thought it was pretty cute at the time, or a little insulting?
No comment.
No comment.
Actually, the green uniform didn't throw me at all. What I was worried about, and they changed it now, was we all went into drab buttons and so forth. There was no regimental flashes allowed, we had no collar dogs established in those days, and we were all looking far too plain. Not that I like fancy uniforms, I don't want to look like a South American dictator, but at the same time I feel that a uniform has got to show something of the spirit and of the unit to which you belong.
Yeah, not on the reverse. They hang in trinkets often to tell them that they should be dressed in blue or dressed in khaki.
I don't like trinketry, as I don't like shooting medals and so forth worn on your uniform. But the point is that I think we could have got, if everybody had been allowed to wear their regimental buttons and their regimental collar dogs and their regimental flashes right from the start, we could have ended up with a green uniform. The logistics of an all-green uniform made sense as far as supplies. So I'm talking about the pure logistics thing. But they didn't need to go to the extent of putting silly-looking buttons on them and this sort of thing. They could have left it very much so that people, even sailors love to wear the tally of the ship. That's what they call it, the little thing they wear on there. They were proud of belonging to the Uganda or whatever ship they were on, just as we were proud to belong to the Strathconas or the PPCR.
Or whatever.
Exactly.
By taking that away.
Yeah. And this is one of many dreadful mistakes that were made that just destroyed morale.
Well, do you think it's still destroyed?
Oh, I find that when I go down and see the Patricias here locally, as I frequently do, they're good. And they look good. They look like Patricias to me.
The Patricias don't count.
I told you the wonderful story once about the Patricias, eh? A certain general who was giving a lecture on the fact that he said that he did not really see what all the fuss was about when they were taking people from the Black Watch and putting them in the Patricias and the Patricias putting them in the RCR and so forth. He said, in my case, I was in three different regiments and I was proud to wear their badges all the time. And the one private soldier shouted out from the audience, "Yes, sir, but you were never in the Patricias." This is the kind of spirit I like among soldiers.
Yeah, but you see, the Patricias don't count because they're all soldier down there, and the governments come and go, and uniforms come and go, but the Patricias know where they're going. I think that's the point. But I'm talking about those folks down at Naden and Dockyard that are walking around with their hands in their pockets, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm not just talking Navy. I'm talking about the unified forces. When a young graduate from Royal Roads has to make excuses about his new uniform. There's something definitely amiss there.
I think it might have been a mistake to put the Navy in green, especially in view of the fact that Navy blue is worn by, I guess, all the navies of the world, and when you're in port, you more likely have to take a bit of flack from the others saying, "What are those guys doing?" I'm not supporting the idea of the green uniform. What I'm saying really is that as far as the Army is concerned, had it been brought in with the proper retention of regimental buttons and collar dogs and flashes.
That was claimed, you see. That was one of Hellyer's great rationales, is that all useful traditions and...
Will be maintained. They weren't.
And they weren't. They had to fight tooth and nail to get them back.
Yes.
Small victories.
Small victories.
to get a little red patch that says PPCLI, or to,
I don't think they've even got the red patch, but I know the colonel of the regiment wears it.
See, a lot that wear it. No, I guess what I'm getting at is that, was there a great, let's get back to the technical part here. In the Navy, they had their sacrificial lambs. They had Landy Moore and a few others that, and those, I think there was 70-odd people that retired, and of those 70, 40 or whatever retired early. I think in the Navy itself, they made their great stand, and in the Arthurian tradition of winning the debate and losing the vote, they're great martyrs. What about the Army?
I think the two people that left us that made me very sorrowful. Well, first of all, Bob Monsell, because he was, as I've told you in an earlier tape, quite my hero when he was a young brigadier commanding 4 Armored Brigade in the war. He'd been a very effective officer through the peace, and I hated to see him go. And Frank Fleury, to my mind, was the, I can say it unequivocally, the smartest man I ever worked for. A real brilliant person. And it broke my heart when he left. But they were the two that, to my mind, we missed very badly, who left because of the feet.
Was there a lot of feet dragging? Let us
be perfectly honest. There was a lot of people who didn't like what was going on, and I don't think they really threw their weight behind it. My idea of being a...
I'm not even saying throwing your weight behind it, but just getting to the point where a lot of, a little more time at the bar maybe, a little more so if it doesn't get done today, a little inefficiency in spirit, I guess, esprit de corps is what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think that is a fair thing. I don't know about more time at the bar, because anybody who worked for me who spent very much time at the bar didn't work for me very long.
Okay, but you know what I'm getting at, the general idea of just... If they can treat me like that, well, that's fine. I'll treat them the same
thing. Yeah. Well, of course, I admired more the people who resigned on a matter of principle than those who stayed behind and, by doing things as you describe, did minor sabotage to the effort.
What about those that really swung behind it and were the gung-ho? I'm thinking of the Air Force, I guess, in particular. Some in the Air Force, not all by any stretch.
Some in the Army, some in the Navy.
Some in the Navy, well, the promotion, at least the talk of promotion. I'm trying to think of anyone who really did get promotion.
We had a couple that went from 1 star to 3 stars in a matter of months, I guess.
Really?
They were
good. How were they treated? How were they viewed? Not treated?
I don't think... people changed their mind about opportunists. They were opportunists when there was only one service. They became even more opportunistic, if there is such a word, when integration and unification fell upon them.
Fair enough. You're not, well, I guess you're not a fish head. You're not in the Navy. You're not crying about it.
I accepted it. I felt that we could continue to be an efficient force. And I'm still talking about integration. I'm not talking about unification yet. This is where I had my great difficulties in understanding it.
Well, unification?
Well, the point is that there are...
Well, what is your definition, sir? Maybe that would be the best...
Oh, well, unification is when we all get marching towards the same goal, right? With people in... Navy, Army, and Air Force disciplines all going towards a common goal. And if that meant wearing common uniforms and common underwear, that's first class. In the unification, when they started to talk about such bloody nonsense as an airman commanding the brigade in Europe and soldiers going, Pongos going to sea and things of that nature, and that was soon quashed as being nonsense. But on the operational side, you had people working in an ops room in essentially a land op that knew absolutely nothing about land operations. It was just unbelievable at the time of the October crisis in 1970, where we in the Army were taking direction on an Army operation from people who knew absolutely nothing. Well, we'd take it over ourselves. That was the thing. In other words, you can't run. I couldn't run an Air Force operation. I couldn't run a naval operation, but I can run an Army operation. And the same thing applies to all. There are no geniuses that can run all three. And the point is, if you get an integrated staff, if it's an integrated problem, that's great. And you had that in World War II, when you had the three services working together, you had an integrated staff. But we had it as a day-to-day business. And that doesn't work. And it didn't work. And it will never work.
You're still doing it. Not in the ops, perhaps, but they're still putting, as you say, Pongos to sea and...
Well, that's fine. Get them seasick.
Do you think it... Do you have any feelings towards taking airmen out and throwing them into a naval base on a staff position, taking a staff Army officer and putting them on the provider?
Logistics is logistics, and are there logisticians that could possibly work, and I think it has worked in many cases, but as long as you don't get them involved in the operational part of it. And then, you see, most operators like to think that the logistical tail is being supported by somebody who knows something about the operation. My student body at Staff College when I was there had ordnance officers and service corps officers, all the things, the people who kept us supplied, and they understood the land battle. Not the forward placing of the Bren gun on the ground or anything like that, but what the land battle was all about, these logisticians. Mm-hmm. And they were trained to do that at the Staff College. So you never looked over your shoulder. You knew that the Remy and the Ordnance and the Service Corps had top-notch officers in it who understood the land battle, and they would make sure that you had the sinews to fight the battle with. Here we get another preposition thrown in there. But however, that disappears. But I do believe that in the logistical tail, it is possible to switch jobs around.
Okay, enough said. You remained in Winnipeg?
Well, for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then I was promoted to Major General to come to Ottawa as Deputy Chief of the Staff for Force Development. And that was my first tour as a Major General.
Now you've gone... You're sort of going back to old ground again after being Director of Combat Development.
Exactly. Now I was doing much the same thing, but on a tri-service basis. And in addition to that, whereas in Combat Development, I didn't get mixed up with the budgetary implications of neoteric warfare. In this particular case, I was very closely tied in and deciding how many of the bucks should go this way and that way, or suggesting, not making the decisions, but going up to ministerial level with the suggestions.
Now, what about during this period, would we have the cutbacks in NATO and other things, and a new emphasis, if you will, on what Canada's defense policy should be? What were your feelings?
The Dare Committee had been sitting, Mike Dare, in charge of a committee, when I was still Deputy Commander of Training Command, and I used to fly from Winnipeg down to Ottawa and put in my 2 cents worth on what I thought Training Command needed to carry out their mission. When I got to Ottawa as a Major General, I continued to work with Michael Dare on this particular thing. And that was at the time they started cutting back. And my job was, when the decisions were taken, to see if we could keep a viable force from all three elements going on the bucks and manpower that we had left, and particularly to make sure that there was enough money in futures to make sure that the equipment would not be all clapped out by the before the new equipment started to come in. I don't think that's too successful. I don't think any DCFD has been successful in doing that, because it takes a lot of manpower and a lot of bucks to do it.
What about equipment replacement? The Navy's a good example. They're floating around in buckets that should have been scrapped 10, 15 years ago. The Air Force, my God, they haven't had a new plane in many years. Of course, they're still talking about the new one coming. And the Army, who has gained the poor cousin.
I think if you've got to look at an organization called KRE, the Operation Research Establishment. You've got to have idea, man. You've got to have people dealing with the future. You've got to have people who can get into a think tank and say, let's not have another aircraft carrier when the aircraft carrier might be sunk so easily now compared to the old days. You've got to have people who decide whether the tank is still viable in the battlefield. I told you in a previous tape, it was my personal opinion that it was viable. I didn't come to that opinion because I'm a tank man. I came to that opinion because of a series of war games we played under the Operational Research Establishment, not only in Canada, but in the United States and Great Britain. In other words, you've got to have some future thinking. Mm-hmm. And you've got to have that future thinking backed up by present expertise. I hate that word expertise. Expertness, I guess. The thing is that that is how you decide. Not because the ships are falling to pieces or the tanks are falling to pieces or the infantrymen's boots are falling to pieces. What you've got to decide is, do you need warships in the future? And if so, what kind? Do you need tanks? If so, what kind? Do you need boots? Do you need infantrymen? These are the decisions that have to be taken. They can only be done by people in a think tank backed up by operational research scientists and people with some knowledge of the military. And that combination and think tank can tell you what you're going to require in the future. That the lobbying of sailors, soldiers, and airmen to replace equipment that was no longer viable in a futuristic war was the thing that made me really pissed off, is the only word I can use to describe it.
There was a lot of that, I assume.
Not a lot of it. Without really applying some intelligent future thought as to what we were going to do and what we needed to do it properly.
How did you combat these feelings?
Oh, my usual pleasant personality.
You remain as Deputy Chief Defense Staff for Force Development for approximately how long?
Oh, about a year. When I go there, I went there in 68, and then in about a year and a half, I guess, and then I became Deputy Chief for Intelligence and Security, and I think this is one of the reasons was the fact that I was a bilingual and things were a little
dicey.
Quebec? Yeah, Quebec at the time. And I was there through the October crisis.
No, I know you're not allowed to divulge too much, but I'm wondering if you could, what you can divulge and are willing to.
What I can divulge is that the soldiers that were called out during the emergency were wonderful. And I mean that sincerely. You've heard me say this about them in battle, you've heard me say this about peacekeeping, and I say it again about that particular day. Do you know of any incidents where soldiers were involved when they were standing all over the place? This is what you can do with well-trained, well-disciplined, non-political troops, or apolitical troops. And that's what we have. Mm-hmm. Never been more proud of being a Canadian soldier than I was during the October crisis. I don't think there's any country in the world that could have put those troops on the street without incidents. But we did.
Though you're not allowed to talk about things that were coming in at that point, and I understand that, do you think the Canadian Army should have been involved, should have been called out for October, or is that something you're not allowed to discuss?
Decision, political decision, nothing to do with us at all. But when we were called out,
then it was yours.
That was ours. And I think we did it to the Queen Station. Remember, at the same time as Cross was being held in Durance Vile and Laporte's body had been discovered, so we were running the nuclear planning conference in Ottawa with all the NATO countries, the heads of state and their defense ministers and their external affairs minister equivalent in town. And we did all the security for that. Great. Did it beautifully. my director of security. What a great guy he was. Bomber Bateman. And one of the things was to protect these famous station and so forth. It was necessary to be armed, but concealing the arms.
Discreet.
Exactly, very discreet. So I found it necessary to get some money out of the budget to get little 38 pistols and shoulder holsters and things like that. And when they had the big banquet for the nuclear planning conference, I had 38 Provo, all in dinner jackets, all looking as though they were guests and so forth, mingling. And the next morning, I called the director of security in, and I said, "Bomber, I want to congratulate you, and I want you to personally congratulate every one of those 38 people with, in my name, for a wonderful job they did last night." And he was beaming. And as he walked out the door, I said, "But tell them they just shouldn't wear brown boots with a dinner jacket." Of course, nobody had done that. He turned around and he said, "Oh, you son of a bitch." No, but that is an anecdote to show you that these guys were terribly flexible. Here they were doing this sort of thing, and it's all for second nature.
Okay. Terrific. The Quebec situation, you're Quebecois in your own right, I guess, in the sense that you're born and brought up there.
Yeah, I'm a Quebecois, but I'm afraid for the true Quebecois, I'm a Montréalais.
Doesn't cut any ice, eh?
Yeah.
How do you feel about the situation today? Sorry. Well, let me put it differently. Sorry. How do you feel about the business with the Cubs Citadels and their recent jail sentence of...
Oh, once again, I doubt whether a soldier should make, even an ex-soldier should make any remarks about judicial matters. In other words, the judiciary decided that 2 years was sufficient, then 2 years is sufficient as far as I'm concerned. I'm not about to quarrel with a judicial decision.
No, but you were there with the troops all hauled out, all the work and effort and things.
It seems a small penalty to pay, but then maybe the exile from their native land.
Paris is tough.
Yeah.
Tough. Now, the trouble being in charge of security is that you can't talk too much.
That's right. And but to give you a general outline of my job, is I was responsible for all our naval, army, and air force attachés abroad. I was responsible for all the foreign attachés that were in Ottawa, and those that were duly accredited to Ottawa and Washington, because some of the smaller nations only had one covering both places. So I spent a great deal of my time working in that particular line, making sure that they got out to see what we wanted them to see, and try to find as many opportunities we could for them to see what they wanted to see.
What about working with the Americans?
Very good. I've always had the greatest admiration for the Americans, and of course because of the sensitivity of the job, I worked quite closely with the CIA. I knew Mr. Helms very well. I've dined at his house and he's dined at mine, and I've been very impressed by the Americans. Very good.
British, the famous, according to novels, the British are the leaders in intelligence because they can't afford anything else.
You didn't happen to see the television program last night about Burgess and McLean, Philby?
Oh, I think I saw it before, yeah. You didn't think that highly of the British?
No, it's not that.
I got to infer something nasty. Come on.
No. It's actually, they're very good, but we all make mistakes. These guys that become super spies and working both sides of the road are... not really the seedy characters that Jean Le Carré describes in his novels. They're pretty intelligent fellows. And in that case we just mentioned of Philby and Burgess and McLean, they were dedicated communists in their undergraduate days at university, and they worked for the cause all the time, even though they rose to the highest offices in the intelligence and the foreign office. It happens.
Well,
if they hadn't been smart, they wouldn't have got away with it as long as they did.
You retire from this position, sir?
I do. I retired...
Retire early, or was it...
No, on my 50th... In fact, on my 55th birthday, I was in Latimer addressing the Joint Services Staff College in Great Britain. And that was my swan song in the Canadian Forces. And when my lecture was on integration and unification of the Canadian Forces in Canada.
Oh, your last day, did you have something nasty to say?
No, in fact, in my peroration, that's exactly what I said. What a golden opportunity to tout or to bring out all the old anti-integration jokes and start telling everybody what a bad man Mr. Hager was and so forth. Instead of that, I gave them a very factual 45-minute rundown and an hour-and-a-half question period on our noble experiment. After all, the Americans said prohibition is a noble experiment.
That's a great analogy. I gotta keep that. Oh, dear. You're retired. You have the index pension, so of course you're a multimillionaire today.
I would that were true. I ended up with 32 years service, the last four of them being as a major general, so I'm not starving to death, I can tell you that. But,
rightfully so. Chose Sydney from
it goes back a long way. When I came to the British Columbia Regiment early on in World War II, and my wife was a Wren out here on the West Coast, we decided that we would settle out here when I retired. We bought some property out in Ardmore, just across the other side of the peninsula. Then when I came out, found this house here, which we liked, and we bought that and decided to settle down here.
Good. Activities since your retirement, sir, service activities, purely social?
Yes. I've had absolutely nothing to do with the military, except the social occasions, and of course they've been awfully kind to me, as they are at Royal Roads and at Naden, and particularly at the Patricias, and they invite me to all their social functions, change of command parades and things of that nature, trooping of the color, and I always go because I enjoy it so much, but I absolutely have nothing to do. One great difficulty when one is a serviceman is you never seem to be able to dedicate yourself to anything other than your job if you do your job properly. So when I retired, I said I was going to do an awful lot of voluntary social work, and I have. I started off by going on the provincial board of the St. John Ambulance Association, and then I became the provincial commissioner for the St. John Ambulance Brigade.
I'm now the order, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I'm commander of the order.
Commander, sorry, you were companion and commander?
No, I was originally an officer of the order.
Okay, let me get my orders right.
Serving brother is the lower grade of the order. Officer is the next grade. Commander is the third grade. And knight of justice or grace is the top grade. Okay. Well, not top grade, there is a one greater, but...
That'd be Grand Cross.
Yeah, exactly.
But you are a commander?
Commander, right.
Commander of the Order of St. John?
Yeah. And there in St. John, I am now the Deputy Chief Commissioner for Canada, and my specific job is training programs, because that has been a great deal of my life, so I've spent a lot of time in that. I am taking on quite a few jobs for the Canadian Legion, the major one being I built the John O. Anderson Memorial Housing on the East Saanich Road. I was head of that committee, raised $1,500,000. I'm very proud of that particular work. I was tremendously supported by a lot of ex-servicemen. For instance, I got Bunk Carson, who was the chief engineer, to be my engineer for nothing. I got General Norm Ross to be the man, my contact man with the federal, provincial governments. Colonel Tony McLaughlin as my protocol officer to smooth over the rough bumps in my character, and things of that nature. Something that we're very proud of, and as I say, not as an individual, but proud that the military or ex-military man living in this community rallied around me and helped me so much on that. I've also done strange things for the Legion. My wife was chairman of the Poppy Committee for the whole peninsula, and I helped her with that. We, for 6 years in a row, ran the hot dog and hamburger stand on behalf of the Legion. We are drivers in the voluntary driving committee. We two or three times a week take people down to the cancer clinic and things of that nature through the hospital board here. We keep active in politics. I have been president of the Sydney North Saanich Progressive Conservative Association. My wife has been membership secretary of the Social Credit Party. We find tremendous amount to do. In fact, not enough time to do all of it. Now, when people retire and say, I don't know what I'm going to do, I laugh at it. How could we possibly be so lacking in resources? Not knowing. I'm a stamp collector and a coin collector, and I just can't spend... Oh, I'm lucky if I can spend an hour a week on those two hobbies. I play a lot of golf. First year I was here, I got two holes in one. Is that the way to pluralize that? Haven't had one since, but I got quite a lot of cheap publicity in the papers. This guy must have spent a lot of time playing golf and he's in the service.
All in all, it's been music career?
Great career. Nothing I would rather have done. In reflection, I don't think it could have been a happy. I had so many good command jobs. I had so many interesting staff jobs. I didn't have any job that I didn't like. No, and I don't think there's many people who say, oh, I had that time when I was this or that, and I didn't really enjoy that. I have often looked back on my career and said, there was not one day that I wasn't enjoying what I was doing. Some days I was terribly frustrated, I can tell you, particularly when I was DCFT. But really, the only other thing I might have liked better impossible. I've always been interested in training, and I've often wondered whether I might have spent a good career in teaching. I don't know at the university level or maybe at the community college level or something like that, but I do like to see people learn, and I might have liked a career then in that.
I think I'm done. Anything you wish to put down for posterity?
No, other than the fact that I've certainly enjoyed our fireside chats, and I hope I haven't rambled on too much.
No, I think we've batted 1,000 on this one. Major General Tedley, thank you very much.